In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, we have a great guest today. This gentleman has not only got a great handle on real estate and lending associated with real estate, but also served in the U.S. Army for 4 years. And we always love to have vets on the show and see how they've kind of leveraged that into various elements of real estate investing. And I'm talking about Kevin Amalsch. And Kevin is a successful hard money lender and mortgage fund manager. And it sounds like he's also a real estate investor as well. So after 4 years in the U.S. Army, he got his finance degree and started his first real estate investment company, which is still active today. Founder of Pine Financial Group, Inc., and the author of The 45-Day Investor, he has completed well over 2,200 successful transactions. He is a recognized investment expert, a frequent speaker, and has been quoted in the Las Vegas Review Journal, the Denver Post, the Denver Business Journal, Yahoo Real Estate, Forbes, and many more. Well, Kevin, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Bill, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much. And thank you for all the listeners to spend this time with us.
I'm stoked. This is a great topic area. And I'm dying to hear your story. So if you wouldn't mind kind of giving us a little background, I'd love to hear about your background.
Yeah, for sure. You did a great job with that bio. You mentioned I was in the Army for 4 years. It's interesting. I go all the way back to high school. Here I am, this 18-year-old kid. And you know what, Bill? I was so sick of school. I did not want one more second in a classroom. So I got sold on the idea of laser tag. I mean, are you kidding me? I can go into the Army and play laser tag for a living. So I was sold. I signed up and there I was. So I went into the Army as an infantryman, ended up doing 3 years active, 1 year in the National Guard. And while I was in the active duty, I was spending a ton of time in the field. I was living in the barracks. I was eating at the mess hall. I didn't have expenses. So I had a little savings account going. I was like, what do I do with this money? I want to invest it somewhere, not in a savings account. So I started reading books. And I'm sure a lot of your guests have the same book recommendations, but it was Rich Dad, Poor Dad that really pulled me in.
Yep, same here.
And I was like, real estate's got to be it. This is just feels so right. So I bought my first house. I was 21 years old, still in the Army. When I got out of the Army, I moved into that house, moved a roommate in with me to pay my bills. And then I started going to school. But I still wanted to do real estate. And I was in the National Guard at the time. And I had the GI Bill. So I had the GI Bill paying for school and my living expenses. I had the National Guard helping with school. I didn't need any student loans. But you know what I did? I took out student loans. And I did that so I could use that as a down payment to buy my second house. I kept that first house as a rental property, and I watched the cash flow and I watched the appreciation. I was getting those tax benefits we learn about, and I absolutely fell in love with the business. And I knew then this was going to be the product, the commodity, whatever you want to call it, that was going to make me rich. And so I focused in on it, and I started buying one or two houses every single month while I was going to school and I was working at night. It was a tough go, but it was all worth it.
Now, how were you able to buy one or two houses every month, you said?
Yep, no cash. I was broke. I didn't have good credit. I mean, I didn't have good credit. I didn't have bad credit either. I had no credit. I was 21 years old. But it's all about how you structure the deals with the sellers. And I think we're going to talk more about some of my mistakes and things. I think you mentioned that you wanted me to discuss that. But I could tell you that when you in this.
That's great. That is how a lot of people have started that, have went on to build, quite a real estate portfolio. And some of them, it looks like an empire more than a portfolio, but we definitely want to hear about that as well. I mean, because there's a lot of people that are thinking, well, I've got to save up all this money before I can buy my first place. And then after that, I have to wait and save up again for the second place. But it sounds like you found a way to do it. Really quick. I mean, two houses a month. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, it was hard work. I mean, I had to find the right sellers that were in the right situation that I could help them. So I was pounding the phones between my classes in college. I was walking across campus making phone calls to try to find these sellers that were in the, the correct situation for me to help them.
Now, what year was this that you bought your first properties?
I was in 2001, so it was right during the dot-com crash and mm-hmm. leading up to 9/11. So very interesting timing that I got into that. I started Pine Financial, which we'll talk more about in a little bit too, I think, but started that in 2008. So I'm definitely starting these companies right during the major recessions.
Wow. Keep going here. I want to hear how you kind of evolved with it. And you're buying two a month, so I would imagine you had quite a portfolio at the end of a year here.
Yeah, it was one to two a month, averaging just over one a month. And I can tell you how I got started with that strategy. The strategy is the lease option. That's what really got me going. But I was going to the seminars, and I was going to the classes and anything I could provide. And back then, it wasn't as easy to find the information as it is today. But the seminars were all saying, let's do the foreclosure thing. Let's invest in foreclosures. And during this time, there was a lot of people that didn't have equity in their homes. So the gurus would teach you, go negotiate with the lien holder or the lender for what we call a short sell. Pay them less than what's owed on the property for them to release the lien. That way you could negotiate equity into a deal. And so I thought this was going to be how I was successful, Bill. And I really focused in on the short sale thing. And I was knocking on foreclosure doors and meeting with people and talking to them. And I finally found somebody. And the problem is he said he will let me negotiate the short sale and sell me his house. But I had to give him $3,000 to do it. I had a mentor at the time tell me, get control of the house. Go ahead and have him deed it to you. Don't use a contract, just have him quick claim it over to you. So I gave the guy $3,000, and I didn't have $3,000, so I borrowed some of that from a friend. And I went to negotiate the short sale, and I followed the instructions exactly like the book says. It's supposed to be so easy. The bank said no. The bank said no, we're not gonna accept your offer. So there we go. They ended up foreclosing anyway. The seller lost his house. I lost my $3,000, and I decided that maybe foreclosures wasn't the avenue for me to go down. And so I started reading more books, and I read one from Peter Conti. Man, I have a ton of respect for this guy. And in that book, he walked me through how to do lease options. So I bought the forms online. I did not have money for an attorney. I'm not recommending that your listeners do it this way. I'm just sharing with you how I did it. So I got the form online. I read a book, told me how to negotiate it, and I went and started trying it. And I ended up buying a couple of houses that way and decided to join Peter's mentorship program. And that's when it really took off.
Wow. And so you're building up this, and now you're this is the lease option side of it, right? So you've got a whole bunch of properties, a whole bunch of people paying you. You kept going that way, and then it sounds like you changed gears a little bit as you went along.
Yeah, a couple times. What I've learned about all of these negotiations, I don't know, maybe 200 lease options. And
wow.
While I was negotiating all of these, what I learned is I really enjoyed that. I didn't necessarily enjoy the cold calling or the knocking on doors, but I really enjoyed the time I spent inside the living room of somebody's house negotiating with them and trying to put the deal together. And what I learned through that process is any real estate transaction, every real estate transaction, the way you negotiate it and make your offer, depends on how you're going to finance the deal. What's your capital stack look like? What's your debt look like? Are you going to negotiate the lease option or other type of owner carry terms? And so I just naturally migrated over to the financing side of this business. I became a mortgage broker, which was terrible. I had zero control. I was approving people for loans. One day, guidelines would change and they were no longer approved the next day. So that got to be taxing, to say the least. And this was in 2006. I learned to start raising private money. I can get control. And I got another mentor, which has been big for my career. And she showed me how to bring in private capital and loan it out to other investors and charge fees for that. So I started doing that in 2006, and then we all know what happened in 2008.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say that being in the mortgage business altogether would have been really rough at that time. But you got on the other side. And so how did that work with you?
It was great. So I had raised, actually, I thought it was a significant amount of money at the time. It was around $1 million I had raised for. Susan was her name. Her and I worked closely together. I brought in almost all of the capital we were loaning out. I was loaning all the money out. She was focused in other areas.
Is that Susan Lasseter by any chance?
Yeah. Do you know her?
She's been on the show a number of times.
Yeah, so she was one of my early mentors.
She's great. She is great.
Yeah, so she taught me this business, so I owe a lot to her. But as 2008 came, she's definitely an educator, and she's fantastic at it. She's not as much a deal person. She didn't like the in the trenches, and especially during that time with all the turmoil. So we decided to separate, or she decided to separate. She wanted to close down her shop and focus on the education side, and I wanted to do deals, and so that's why we separated, and I started Pine.
Wow. And so tell me what that the shop looked like. And it, also in the with the background of, you know, all these other mortgage companies just collapsing and not to mention the investment firms and other things that just followed suit. Who were you lending to? What were you, you know, what were your typical type of loans and deals?
Yeah, so we were doing pretty much all fix and flip loans. So these are for mom and pop shops that are fixing and flipping houses. We would do high leverage loans, so up to 100% of the costs, as long as we're at a conservative loan to value on the exit. So 70% of the completed value, that was basically the product. Back then we were charging 4 points in origination and 15% interest. A point is a percent of the loan amount and a fee. So I think about $100,000 loan, it'd be $4,000 in fees plus 15% on the interest. Now, the hard money industry has changed significantly since 2008. So we're not getting anywhere near that now. But that's what we were charging back then. And gosh, I got to tell you, you want to talk about the landscape of the industry in 2008. It was complete and utter chaos.
Yeah.
And I could tell you what added to that, and it was so stressful and was so difficult for me to get Pine Financial off the ground, was regulation, which Susan didn't know, I didn't know, neither one of us knew. But to bring in private capital and lend out that money on an individual loan basis, you needed to have a securities license to do that. And I was told that. I asked Susan, she didn't believe it. So what did I do? I called the state regulators and I asked them, do you need a license to do this type of business? And they asked me, are you doing that type of business? And of course the answer was yes. And I got a very fast invitation into their office where I was quickly put under investigation.
And oh, man.
All at the very beginning of when I was trying to get this started. So I had to go through a really stressful and complicated investigation with the state. Came out of that just fine. They actually said, you're doing more disclosures and you're operating at a really high level, more disclosures than the state would even require. So I was able to study and test and get my license. So it all worked out fine, but that's how it all got going.
Wow. And what were the typical terms for, or the length of those loans for the most part?
Yeah, so we were doing 6 months, and some of our competitors were as well. So I tried to separate myself from the competition, and I did a 9-month loan. So 4 and 15 for 9 months.
Gotcha. Now, so you've been in the same business since that time, since 2007, 2008. You know to today.
Yep. I do my own investing on the side, but that's definitely a side almost hobby. I love it so much. I can't stop. But my focus is absolutely on Pine Financial.
Gotcha. And how have things changed over the years? I mean, obviously, there's a very different economy today. I don't know if you see, resemblances to how things were back then, but I would be curious to see how lending has changed in that time period.
Well, there's an industry now. Back then, there was no industry. People didn't even know what the heck private lending was. Now they have like national entities that try to regulate it, and there's conferences several times a year. I just went to a conference for the American Association of Private Lenders, and there's like 600 people there either in the business actively or trying to get in. So the biggest change is there's an industry. With that comes two things. One, institutional investors. So it's not all privately raised capital anymore. You have Wall Street getting into the business. And two, with more people loaning money, it drives prices down. There's more competition. It's more crowded. So we've had to keep up on the pricing side of things. We've had to go out and look for institutional investors, but we've raised a ton of money. We've raised well over $100 million in our multiple mortgage funds. So we're still kind of old school. You talked about that when we got on the Skype call, this little, little old school. We feel the same way. I do a lot of things like we did when we got started.
Oh, wow. And you mentioned back then it was at 15%. What are rates today?
Yeah, right now we're at 2 points in origination, so half of what we used to get, and we're at 12% interest.
Gotcha. And are you doing, is it strictly hard money, or do you have other products that, maybe longer term products as well?
You know, a lot of the competitors are getting into some of that longer term stuff. We're deciding to stay, hyper focused on the short term. So we'll do some bridge, commercial bridge loans, which will go up to 18 months. But everything we do is value add short term.
Gotcha. And, with the things going on with Fannie and Freddie too, or right now, are you finding a lot of activity in the bridge loan area, especially on the commercial side?
Oh, absolutely. It's been like that forever, though. When you go into the commercial space, a lot of banks won't finance commercial properties unless they're stabilized, meaning they're producing enough income to pay for the loan. The property is more important to a bank than even the individual guarantor. So if it's not producing enough income, you won't get the loan. So we really focus on that niche of, this real estate asset needs to be repositioned to produce income. So maybe it's an apartment building that just is totally vacant, or maybe it's a hotel that needs to be converted, or we do a lot of warehouse conversions to small bay or storage. So if there's some way that you could reposition and produce income, there's a high demand for that.
Are there generally longer term, I would think, especially if you're doing, some major renovation on an apartment or a industrial property, something like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's two reasons for this. One is because it takes a long time to get through your capital improvements. So we're looking at 18 months typically. But banks require title seasoning before they'll refinance you out. Now, if you go to the Fannie and Freddie route, they don't have any title seasoning. So I could buy a single family home, fix it up, get it get it reappraised at a new, improved, higher value, and Fannie Mae will look at the new improved value and will ignore what I paid for it. That's not reality on the commercial side. The banks really do want to see 12 months of seasoning before they'll use a new appraised value. So we need to season the property for 12 months anyways. So it works out perfect. They need to season it 12 months, and we need to do some CapEx, and then we can get the refinance done.
That's great. Well, this, it sounds like you've got just a winner here. You've obviously stuck with it for a long time. But I'm sure you've encountered your mistakes and challenges there that you've learned from. What would you say, you could even go to as an investor as well as in the hard money business. What are some of those challenges that you had to deal with?
Yeah, interesting. My biggest mistake as a private money lender was calling the regulator to ask for advice. Absolutely don't do that. Call an attorney, someone who's actually going to be on your side. That would have been a much smarter move for me. On the investing side, gosh, I've made so many mistakes, Bill. It's hard for me to even pick one. I know that foreclosure story that I shared was a pretty big one that impacted me a lot. My very first tenant, I did not screen. So I had my very first rental property, my very first tenant, and my very first eviction. So that was pretty bad. But I think the biggest mistake I've made was setting my goals incorrectly. And I was so concerned with that one property a month. I wanted to look cool at the real estate investment clubs. And I wanted people to look up to me. And all of that stuff was important. And so it's very easy to look like you're successful when you're doing a high number or high volume, but they could be terrible deals, right? So my goal was one house a month, and by God, I was going to hit that goal even if I had to buy deals that were marginal. And I did that leading up to the biggest crash in housing history. So I really did take a bath there, and I learned the very important lesson that I don't really care what people think anymore. My goals are all around what's important for me and my family and my values and you know, what I could do for, you know, other people.
Right. Now, are you still doing lease options, or are you doing more traditional long-term rentals? In your personal portfolio, what are you focusing on?
Yeah, so I've graduated from the single family lease option stuff. I think that's fantastic. And I could have been very happy just staying in that arena, but it does somewhat put a cap on you. It's hard to scale that business. Very, very profitable, but it's just hard to scale. So I don't do that much anymore. I'm really looking for, on the investing side, much larger projects. So let me give you an example. We just purchased a 30,000 foot warehouse in Minneapolis. I got a lot of connections in Minneapolis because we do business out there. And we have a single tenant. It's a good year. So now we're trying to work with them to renew their lease. We got a fantastic deal on this because their lease is expiring. So that would be one example. But I really like much larger projects, you know, seven-ish figures on an exit. I'm trying to be humble here, but I need it to be large enough for me to be interested in it.
Are you syndicating on any of these deals?
I've done one syndication, developed an 80-acre parcel in Colorado, 150 houses. There's like 200 attached houses, and then a little small piece of it was commercial. What I learned from that process is it's very challenging when you have investors involved in a single purpose entity and the project doesn't go exactly as planned. So I'm deciding not to syndicate anymore. I'd rather do everything on my own, or maybe one or two very close partners that I have relationships with.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned sort of mistakes, sort of on the other side, what things did you do well in the beginning that you have, has become an integral part of your organization?
Yeah, now 2008 really humbled me. So I've gotten over this. Some people would say this is good. Some people say it was bad. But I'll tell you what, Bill, I wouldn't be where I am without it. And that's the ready, fire, aim mentality. If I wasn't so willing to take action, even if I knew I might miss, then I wouldn't be where I am today. So I think being able to just face a fear, understand that there's going to be mistakes, and continue to move forward.
That's great. That's great. I'm hearing more and more of that from people that, you know, that one of the biggest mistakes a lot of people say is the, you know, not pushing the button, you know, not taking that step. And, you know, it just being too concerned with the risk and then later on realizing, oh, gee, you know, if I would have done that, if I would have, could have, should have, you know.
So, exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, you know, our audience are folks that are 50 years of age or older. They're people that are approaching retirement or they're in retirement already, and they're looking at real estate investing and associated industries there as a means to be able to not only generate cash flow, but to, you know, grow their nest eggs as well. And now with, you know, with inflationary pressures, recession, all these things happening, you know, there's more concern than ever in being able to sustain, you know, for the entire lifetime. What suggestions or advice would you have for those folks in terms of how, what you know and what you're familiar with would be a great way to be able to help them in those goals of theirs?
Yeah, we could talk about this for a while. I love the fact that you're doing this podcast, Bill, because this is helping them. We got to get our mind and our mind out of Wall Street constantly, because look what happens on Wall Street, 25% loss in less than a year. Now it will go back up, and I understand that, but you don't see that kind of fluctuation in Main Street investments. So what you're doing and helping people understand the real estate industry and different ways that they could profit in it, getting onto Main Street, I think, is super important, at least for diversification, if nothing else. But some ideas, one thing it's hard to answer is each individual situation is going to be different. So 50 is not that old. They could absolutely be buying fix and flips or lease options or doing something like that if they want to grind a little bit and put in some effort and make a tremendous amount of money. If they're looking for more passive income, maybe it's a turnkey rental, or maybe it's private lending, like a little bit of what we talked about today. What I will say with the private lending side, although I believe if it's done right, is the most safe you could be, as a lien holder, you get paid first. So if there's a problem with your borrower, you will get your money back before they do. I think that puts us in a really comfortable position, especially if we're at a low loan to value. So if there's any fluctuation in the market, but you have to do it right. So to share a real quick story, I'm sure you talk about self-directed IRAs in your podcast, Bill.
Uh-huh.
We have a lot of self-directed IRA investors, and there's this one individual. She invested her entire self-directed IRA into a private money note, and she went into a junior position behind us. She called us when it was way too late to help her, and she ended up losing her entire account because she went into a junior position lien without the proper understanding that she needs to be able to take out the first. If she has to foreclose, she would have had to pay us off in order to get the property. She didn't understand that. You know, a lot of the national gurus tell you, well, gap fund this. Get as much money as you can from your hard money lender and go get private debt to cover the gap. Well, if your hard money lender is going to stop you at a certain point, that's probably a good place to stop. The more you put debt on it, the more risk you're taking. And then those junior lien holders are in a tremendous amount of risk. So that's one example, but there's a ton of different mistakes I see private lenders make. So I would say absolutely look at this business. It's passive and it can be very, very safe, but be careful.
Now, does your company have vehicles for investors, funds, or ways where they could also generate passive income?
Yeah, we do have a public fund, which I'm really excited about. So we can accept accredited and non-accredited investors. There's no limitations on either one. We do some individual note investing too. So if we will sell off individual notes to free up some cash, so there's an opportunity there. And you know, when you're working with a broker or a company like us that underwrites and services the loans, now you're working with someone who understands what they're doing and they can help you stay safe.
That's great. That's great. Wow. Well, it sounds like you really created a real nice company and culture there. It sounds like what are you excited about in the future for your company?
Yeah, I touched on it a little bit. It's that public fund. So we everything I've done to this point has just been through private offerings. So I have to have the securities license. I have to offer people inside my network these opportunities. I have limitations on accredited investors versus non-accredited investors. And then I created a public fund for the states of Minnesota and Colorado with an attorney that forgot to tell me one piece of information that was vital. And that was Colorado, you don't need audited financials. Minnesota, you need fully audited financials. And I was not getting fully audited financials. So we went out of compliance. So I hired a different attorney and was like, fix this. And they said, well, we have to start a new fund, get everybody moved over, and then we'll stay compliant. Well, since I needed audited financials anyways, I went the full blown, it's called a tier two Reg A. And now I could raise money in all 50 states, really high cap on the amount I could raise. And I could advertise, I could promise a return, I could do all kinds of things that I was never able to do before. And it's fully approved by the SEC, so that's really exciting.
God, that's great. And what requirements would be related to, you know, that fund in terms of, you know, minimum investment amount, what's the yield, and, you know, is it paid quarterly, monthly, how would that work?
Yeah, so it's really simple. The business is simple. We've talked about that here today. The minimum is only $10,000. We lowered it way, way down because I know people are hurting right now from the stock market and the bond market and crypto. And if we could get some diversification into their portfolio, I think it would help. So we decided to lower our minimum all the way down to $10,000.
That's great. Wow.
It pays a flat 8% and it pays out every single month. Investors can either reinvest the money so it'll grow like a savings account. That's pretty cool because they have compound interest. Was it Ben Franklin said that's the eighth wonder of the world?
Right.
Or you can take your money and do a direct deposit every month if you're looking for cash flow or income.
And it's secured by real estate, right? I mean,
yep. All of the loans we make are secured by real estate. We get full valuations. Typically, it's a full appraisal. Sometimes we do BPOs if it's a pretty safe loan.
That's great. That sounds like a great, and you accept accredited and not accredited investors too. That's a great product. Because I get asked all the time, and you know, it's been tough for you know, some unaccredited folks to be able to get into the good deals, and that sounds like a good one. Wow. Also, you know, I just wanted to, you know, touch on this too, is just looking at the economy in general right now, I know that you've been through a couple of recessions there already. What do you see in today's economy, and how would you advise people in terms of their investments to look ahead in dealing with that?
Yeah, this is a topic that comes up every single day. I'm sure it does for you too, Bill. I compared this recession, which I believe we are in a recession. I compared this to the 2008 crash, and why I don't think it's the same, and why I feel it's going to, at least in real estate, it's going to be a pretty soft landing, or at least much softer than what we've seen before. And I got some hate mail. People did not agree with me at all. And they said, you're looking at the wrong recession. It's not 2008 that's comparable. 2008, housing created the recession. This recession is created by the government that we think may affect housing. So it's very different. So these people were telling me, you're looking at the wrong recession. Go to 2000 or go to 1990, mm-hmm. what came out of the savings and loan. So I studied that recession and put out another video, and I wrote a whole report on comparing 90 to today too. So I feel like neither one of them are comparable, quite honestly. Right now we have the most equity we've ever had in properties. We have fixed rate loans instead of adjustable rate loans. We have record credit scores, which is a pretty good indication of quality of loan and quality of borrower. And we're still at super low inventory. So nothing shows me, nothing I've seen other than affordability, maybe that could be an argument, really tells me we're going to see a housing crash or a wave of foreclosures or any of that. So I'm not as worried in housing as I am in maybe stock market continuing to fall. So my advice, I know that was way more than you asked me, but what you asked me was what my advice would be. It's hard to give advice.
No, that's a great answer.
It is hard to give advice because we don't have a crystal ball.
Sure.
But I will say that I feel very much more comfortable in real estate because it moves slower and for the reasons I've just said. But I wouldn't put all my eggs in real estate either. I do believe diversification is how you get through a recession like this.
That's great. That's great advice. Also, too, report that you done comparing the 1990 to the 2008, is that something that's public that people can access?
Yeah, absolutely. You know what I could do? I have another report to help people stay safe if they want to lend their money to other people. I just hate to see.
That sounds great. Yeah.
I hate that story of the $80,000 loss. I mean, that really hurts me. So I wrote that report. You can get that at thepinereport.com. And I'll tell you what, Bill, for you, I'll upload on that same domain. I'll upload this comparison from 90 to today. So both reports will be up there.
That's great. Yeah. Cause I did want to go in a little bit more into, you know, people that want to do it on their own and some of the risks involved, but sounds like this report will probably be able to give a lot more detail than we would have had time for here. So that sounds great. That sounds great. Well, we're getting near the end of our interview here, and we have a segment called Wrap It Up, where I ask you a series of quick questions, kind of like a lightning round on resources that you have used and have been valuable for you as a real estate guy and lender. So if you're ready, we'll go ahead and wrap it up.
Let's do it.
All right. Favorite real estate book?
So my favorite real estate book has to be The Multiple Streams of Income there's a couple of them out there with that same title, but it's Multiple Streams of Income, Buying Properties with No Money Down, something like that, by Peter Conti. The reason that is because it's the one that really got me going.
Excellent. Excellent. How about just a favorite general business book?
You know, it's hard to not say Traction. I'm actually rereading that for the third time right now.
Great book.
I think The E-Myth, honestly, might even be better. I really got a lot out of The E-Myth.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. Yeah, excellent book, too. How about a website that you use just all the time that's been invaluable for your business?
My CRM is where I'm at all the time, but I like Redfin a lot. I like setting up searches and saving those searches and getting email deals. I bought several properties that way. And for a really fast search on valuation, I use it, but I want to warn you that it is an automated valuation model and it's not always accurate.
Right.
But I do use Redfin.
Oh, that's excellent. How about a favorite app on your phone that you use on a regular basis?
You know, I think any app that title companies put out, I'm getting on my phone right now to look at which one I'm using. It's called My First Am. So it's the First American app, but it gives you like marketing lists and all. I can look up the owners of all the properties anywhere in the country and how much they owe on the property. And I get all my research done on that one app. But
God,
any
that's
title
great.
Company app. That.
My First AM, is that when you said My First M or my?
Yeah, My First AM, like American. So My First AM.
Okay, got it. Yep. Excellent. How about a favorite quote?
This is one that my dad drilled into my head when I was growing up. He said, whether you believe you can do it or you don't, you're right.
Yeah. I think that came from, wasn't that a... oh gosh, just trying to think of who originated that. But
Seen it by, I don't know, honestly, but I have seen other people, multiple people take credit for it, but I don't know
right.
where it actually originated from.
That's true. And our final question here, if you lost absolutely everything, all your assets, and you had to start over, knowing what you already know, and all you have is $1,000 in cash, what would you do to relaunch your business?
Well, I had less than that when I started, so I'd probably do the exact same thing. I would just be much, much better at it now. So the lease options, I would go that direction, but I would do a two-prong. I'd also start trying to build relationship with people who have money that are willing to invest in and with me. So I guess there'd be a two-prong, lease options and start building a relationship with money partners.
Great, great approach. Wow. Well, this has been fantastic. I got more information than I expected. Just great stuff, Kevin. Plus the ancillary stuff too that people can click on and download as well. So, how do folks find out more about you, especially those that may be interested in getting involved in this fund or finding out more information about what you do?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I'll put those reports. It's thepinereport.com for those. And then to reach me, you could find us on our website. It's www.pinefinancialgroup.com.
Great. Wow. Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for being on. But we have a tradition here. We're called the Old Dogs. And so all of our guests get to close us out with their best old hound dog howl. And so are you up for that?
I saw that on here and I was thinking, man, I bet you Bill's going to show me how to do it. So how do we do this?
Anytime you've heard a dog howl or, a lot of people use sort of the default wolf sound.
Yeah, I was going to practice that before I got on here and I was like, I sound like a wolf.
that's okay too. Just give it your best shot.
All right.
Oh, wow. That was a good one.
That was definitely a wolf, not a hound dog.
Oh, well, gosh, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Bill, thanks so much for having me. I hope this was valuable for your listeners. Really appreciate it.
No, great stuff. And I think it's very timely. I think it's going to be perfect for people and where they're at right now. I also want to thank not only you, but all of our old dog listeners out there for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Now, please note that everything that Kevin talked about will be detailed along with all the links and all that stuff in our show notes at the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And you're going to look for the episode with Kevin Amalsch. Well, that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.